Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special Penske podcast. Look at us, we're on video, we can wave and talk. We've got the content that we're going to be talking about running in the background. That's going to be Chaos on the Bridge. If you haven't tuned in before, this is the Penske podcast where we're running through all 178 Star Trek The Next Generation episodes. And this is kind of a very special episode. We're going to be talking about the documentary that Shatner produced about TNG's first 3 years, which is probably the weirdest collide of content that you could possibly imagine. And if you're listening in the podcast and you've been downloading it through iTunes, this one I'd recommend going to the YouTube channel because, as I just mentioned at the top, me and Clay are live here in person on your screens, and I'm going to be putting in clips from the documentary as well. So it's good for that. Otherwise, thank you for listening on the podcast through iTunes. But anyway, let's get to it. Clay, how are you?
I'm good. I'd like everyone to know I didn't know this was happening. He just showed up with a camera in my face. So if I look like I'm sweating like Roger Ebert, I apologize.
It's a nice glisten. The makeup lady will be coming in every. We got the moving trucks outside beating down.
Everything's working. This is a top notch production you got here, Wes.
Anyway,
we are here at the Charlie Rose set to talk about Star Trek.
We got the Enterprise front center. Chaos on the Bridge. You can get it on Vimeo. I guess it came out last year. It's about a year old, which is kind of surprising. You can get it on Vimeo, I think, for $12, something like that. It's a little bit more than you think it should be. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the basic breakdown is William Shatner, for some reason, I guess just to keep his name out there, produced this documentary about the first 3 years of Star Trek The Next Generation, which he was not involved with. Obviously, Shatner's involved with the original series. The common thread is Roddenberry. So the documentary basically goes through the first 3 years of all the trials and tribulations that Star Trek The Next Generation had, starting with the original writers that Roddenberry brought in. Roddenberry's sort of psychological, I don't know if you'd call it disorder, but his like psychological leanings to what he was doing, how it affected the show, him getting sick and sort of leaving and the new writing team coming in to talk about it. So let's start off with like a big concept. What was your biggest surprise from this documentary?
My biggest surprise was that the credits for this documentary say written and directed by William Shatner. I was 98% sure he was just hired to do it, but it seems like something he was actually interested in. And you say, you know, why did he do it? Was it just to keep his name out there? He seems to have, like, he had a show for a while on, I think, Spike, where he would just have people on and just do these really interesting interviews.
Really?
So I think he might just...
He likes interviewing?
Yeah, he might just be fascinated. I mean, and the fact that... I guess my biggest surprise was I thought this was going to be just like a general TNG documentary.
Yep.
But the fact that it was specifically geared to seasons 1 to 3 made it that more interesting.
Yeah.
That being said, I feel like it's very rushed. Overall, it's a very strangely put together documentary.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. I thought when I bought it, this is my biggest surprise about it, besides the honking. It's moving day. It's September 1st in Boston, Massachusetts. So there's no universe. It's the Spinal Tap joke. There's no Boston's not a college town.
Correct.
So no one's moving in.
Nope.
But anyway, the my biggest takeaway from the documentary, the biggest surprise was that when I bought it, I thought it was going to be... I've watched so many documentaries about a subject that's made by someone close to it where it's just like just niceties. Like the Seinfeld DVDs come to mind. Like the behind the scenes stuff about Seinfeld is everyone going like, it was a great time.
That surprises me a little bit.
Everyone was having fun. I guess it's just such a valuable property that they don't want to really badmouth it. This is a pretty angry documentary.
Yeah.
Like there's a few people, some people are very polite and won't say bad things, but they'll do the thing like, it was a little difficult.
Yeah.
They'll say that. And then the other guys will be like, Roddenberry was a fucking asshole and he screwed me over and he screwed everybody over. And you goddamn put that in the documentary.
I was surprised how many conflicting stories there were and how I actually liked it because it's called Chaos on the Bridge. And maybe the point of it was to try and show how chaotic everything was because the whole documentary is a very chaotic affair.
Yeah.
Like it starts off, I thought I was waiting for it to start. because they do this thing that, you know, they do at the beginning of a lot of documentaries where they kind of do like quick little cuts of people saying stuff, and then they kind of slow it down and they're like, back in 1987, it just, once it starts, it's just like cut, and it just kept going.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden, they're up to season two, and I was like, oh, I don't know if I've seen any credits yet for this.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, the intro credit scene is very right. The intro does the stylistic thing. They chose to make, like, not anime, they chose to do, like, cartoonish drawings. Yeah.
Very nice drawings, actually.
Yeah, they're well done. A lot of them, too.
Yeah, like someone that guy did a lot of work. So, and his name is not in the credits, I noticed at the end.
Drawn by William Shatner.
Gene's ideas about the future and about man are wacky doodle.
Red alert! Shields up!
He was a flawed man. He had great virtues, he had great flaws.
I thought Gene was going to come across the table at me.
I saw firsthand Gene's battling with the studio.
Gene was considered somewhat of a pain in the neck. He was kind of a blustery guy.
Gene wasn't the easiest person to get along with, but he stuck up for his beliefs and his concepts.
There's just a lot of infighting. It was all chaos.
There's really scary stuff going on. There's a lawyer going around looking in people's desks when they're not there.
I spent the first couple years just worried I was going to be fired.
My agent was the first person to tell us there wasn't a hope in hell that this show will even make it through the first season.
The production value is really high. Mm-hmm. It's not like it was literally thrown together. It's just fascinating that it's the way it came out. And I think the one big glaring weakness is I feel like they were trying to make a theme about power and it was not sticking, but Shatner insists on saying power every single...
Got off the ground and survived the chaos of the first 3 years. I became fascinated with the struggle. Not only the creative struggle, but the struggle for power. Power is ephemeral. It's power.
Gene had the power.
And the power shift.
Rick was seizing power.
Power, power.
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 The power.
And, like, halfway through the animations, well, most of the animations are all Western themed.
Yeah.
And it's usually, like, Gene Roddenberry dressed as a cowboy in a gunfight with Maurice Hurley or something. and there's, like, this, there's other animation that's just, like, constantly running of like a poker game, as you can see right there, actually right behind,
which is kind of Western themed, I guess.
Yeah,
if we continue it.
And
yeah, here we go. Mm-hmm.
And clearly, what happened, because there's a point where I believe it might actually be right here where he's interviewing this guy whose name I can't remember.
Who's a tech?
he's a suit, obviously.
John Pike.
Pike is talking about how he was kind of bluffing Roddenberry in terms of getting the movie, the games, the show started. It was exactly what they're talking about right now. And they keep showing this poker game thing. And then at one point, Shatner goes, like a poker game.
If this program were not blessed by Roddenberry, we would have placed the franchise in serious jeopardy.
These millions of dollars are hanging on his yes to a two-hour thing.
And it's more like tens of millions of dollars. It's a lot of money.
All right. So you were bluffing.
I was bluffing.
Holy cats.
And he knew I was dead serious.
But you were bluffing.
I was bluffing. He blinked.
Play poker?
Occasionally.
And then at the end of the story he goes, do you play poker? And it's like, clearly that clicked in his head, and it's like, it's all poker themed from here on out.
I remember that because it was a little bit awkward because Pike was not totally on board with what Shatner was trying to drive the point home. Or he's like, you were bluffing. He's like, and I think Pike screws up. He's like, but I was telling the truth. But Shatner's like, no, but you were lying, right? He's like, yes, I was lying.
And that's how they wrote that episode where they go to the poker place in space.
Pike has the other story, which we'll talk about in a little bit. The weirdest story, I think, is his story about Patrick Stewart and Patrick Stewart being like, that did not happen.
That's a strange story.
We'll talk about that in a little bit. But yeah, it's the power thing is funny because there's not really a through line of power. Like, this is not the dominant story. Maurice Hurley was not going in going like, I want some power. Give me the power.
Yeah.
But every clip that you get of Shatner, he's insisting this is all about power. He's like, the power fascinated me. And it gets to a point where he's interviewing our favorite writer, Tracy Torme, at one point. And Torme is like, yeah, it was just kind of weird. There's a lot of stuff going on. And Shatner's like, why do you think that was happening? He's clearly leading him to say. And he's like, I think people just didn't get along. And he's like, do you think it was the power? He's like, I guess it could have been the power.
Yeah. Yeah, it's – I kind of feel like – I kind of feel like he didn't take the right approach in general with the subject. Because like you said, the angle he was going feels a little forced. And I think there is more of an interesting angle in there when it comes to – because they mentioned a thing about halfway through that I found kind of fascinating, which was that the classic Gene Roddenberry ideal that everyone's familiar with of like, oh, he had this ethos of perfect future where everyone's nice to each other and shit.
Yeah. There's no conflict.
Yeah, there's no conflict, which – basically everything I thought about the writer's room, they confirmed for me, which I was really happy about. But they mentioned that that version of Gene Roddenberry happened after the original series.
Because
the original series was just the way that whoever was describing it describes it as just like an adventure show.
Yep. The guy gets the girl, punches out the bad guy.
Yeah. What was, I forget what the term they used to describe it, but it was really good. It was like, something in space.
Okay.
Like, tractor, not a tractor pull, but like,
I'll drop the clip.
Yeah. If you can find it. But the idea that between the original series going off the air and the Next Generation, he had done all of these, college.
We did conventions and
stuff. Conventions and college speaking. And he kind of like refined his own personality, like his own, the way that he projected himself and kind of turned himself. There's a part in the documentary where they make where he talks about actually L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah, he was a friend of
L. Ron and Hubbard. Roddenberry says, if I wanted to, I could probably do the same thing. And it occurred to me, it's really funny actually, because I was watching I think I was at a bar or something and the TV was on, and I saw Roddenberry's face because they were playing a clip from something, and I couldn't place who it was.
Yep.
And the first thing I thought was, oh, it's L. Ron Hubbard.
They do look remarkably similar. Oh, sort
L.
Of
Ron
like,
Hubbard's got like that weird, he's a weird looking guy. He looks like a broken down puppet, kind
of. There's a picture in here of, I think, Roddenberry at this mid-80s, mm-hmm. where he looks very much like my mother's mother. He's got sort of the hair. He's wearing like a colored scarf and everything. It's like, wow, that was
my favorite stock
time.
Photo was they show a stock photo of Isaac Asimov where he's just got like these giant mutton chops, and I didn't realize his hair was that cool.
Sitting in the library. It is weird that Roddenberry developed this thing after the original series, which makes a lot of sense. I never realized it, like you were saying. And then sort of refined it, and it does seem like he was trying to make this some kind of Scientology type thing where he's like, this is in the future, things are going to be better.
Yeah.
It's going to be a lot
different. It makes a lot more sense when you think about the difference between the Next Generation and the original series. Cause they get into the idea that, you know, he put it down that there was no conflict between characters and how much that, that locks up and freezes a writer's room. Cause what the hell else are you going to do?
Right. Which makes sense why they have to bring in guests of the week.
Right.
And
that change in approach makes sense where originally he was just trying to make a show, but now he's trying to put forth like an ethos.
Yep.
Which is, you know, it's difficult.
Right. I guess it makes sense why he's so unbending with it.
Yes.
Although later on, eventually, Morris Hurley leaves because.
I wish they had spent a little bit more time talking about that. Because, like I said, it jumps around so much. It's a lot of, like, one person starts the story, then the next person continues it, then they jump back to the first person, like, in a second interview and that kind of shit. But the through line of Maurice Hurley I found really interesting. Because every time they cut to him, he was just basically telling what sounded like the truth to me. Like, everything he said, I was like, yeah, I'm totally down with this guy.
I get a call from Paramount saying, come and meet Roddenberry. We want to consider you as a writer for Star Trek The Next Generation. I said, that's a joke. It's a joke. But I want to meet Roddenberry. Who wouldn't want to meet Roddenberry? I was coming off two cop shows. I was coming off Miami Vice. Very good show. Equalizer. Very good show.
Yeah, we can talk about Hurley. Hurley was the showrunner for the first 2 years, mm-hmm. basically. It was interesting to get the internal politics where he was hired from the outside, and a lot of the writers were upset because they figured, why is he becoming head writer over us as they've been involved for 20 years?
The thing I found interesting there is people were complaining about, he had just come off of Miami Vice and The Equalizer.
Was that the other show? Yeah.
Yeah, which are both really good shows.
Yeah.
And, but they're cop shows.
Yep.
And, they're, you know, I think they had clips of DC Fontana and probably this guy, I forget his name.
David Gerrold?
Complaining of that, you know, Maurice Hurley had never written sci-fi before, et cetera, et cetera. But it's like, what sci-fi guys would you bring in to run that show?
Right,
like, would you bring in the guy that did the original Battlestar Galactic? No, that's just fucking stupid.
Right. Hurley has the funny story of Roddenberry getting upset with him, saying, you don't know the difference between the shields and the deflectors. Yep. And it's just like, yeah, my take on Hurley is, up to this documentary, I thought he was kind of just a difficult showrunner that a lot of people, like, just from my knowledge of what, like, how the show was sort of panning out that they were doing. Like, he wasn't, probably wasn't a great showrunner, et cetera, et cetera. Roddenberry maybe didn't like him. I think this is all kind of true, but I don't think he's particularly a bad person. If anything, he seems to be one of the most aware people, because he's, I love his joke at the end. He's like, whatever he says the first mistake was, or the first great thing they did was this. The second great thing was not renewing my contract.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, I understand. Cause his whole conflict was, I go in, this guy Roddenberry tells me I have to run a show where there can't be any conflict between the main characters. I try to do that. And I eventually start pitching him stories, and he starts telling me that these stories need more conflict in them, basically.
Yeah.
And he's like, what the hell do you want me to do?
Yeah, he really went out of his way to make sure that he kind of protected the concept.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, basically his story seemed like he came in and he was the one who wanted more conflict for these characters. But then Roddenberry said, no, you can't do that. Here's what we're going to do. And then he, as I guess you would, being the person who's in charge of it, made sure you stuck to that.
Yeah.
And then if Roddenberry's coming back and be like, well, man, and then, I mean, that would drive me insane.
Right.
You know, how do you work in that situation?
Yeah. And he has another story about Roddenberry. You can understand why the writers would have hated it, because they would go to him with a script and he'd say, I don't like this script, and throw it out. And he makes the analogy of TV is just a sausage factory. Like, you have to keep the scripts coming. You have to send the scripts down to production because the actors are waiting around for something to do. You need the shows coming out every week. So you can't start on a script and then be like, I don't like this anymore. You just have to, like, push them out. You just have to get through it. And I can imagine that being wildly annoying to have
to, especially because he mentions that, you know, they would finish one script and Roddenberry would say, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. Let's do something else. His new idea would be different, but it wouldn't be any better.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like, why not just do both, or do the first one and then we can do this? So I can see that being incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. He's a funny character. I think if anything, I learned the most about him, Hurley, through this whole process.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem a bad guy. I can understand why working with him would be frustrating. I think he's the kind of person that, a lot of people would not get he's sort of sarcastic. He's like he sounds angry, but I don't think he's really angry. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
I think he's very honest in his sarcasm, though.
Yes, but. Gene's ideas are wacky doodle.
Yeah. Did you notice that all of the production companies and shit on this are like wacky doodle productions? Like, it must have been something that Shatner had to put together after the fact.
He's got his list. He's like, poker, animation, wackadoodle.
Yeah.
Power.
My favorite thing, which I wish somebody had footage of, is Patrick Stewart auditioning in a wig.
Yes.
Which I really wish I had seen.
Which they drew.
The most interesting thing. So one thing, the two things I found really fascinating, just as far as the story goes, is they made no mention at all of Star Trek Phase 2. Which was supposed to be what ended up turning into the first movie.
Yeah.
And a lot of those ideas ended up going into TNG.
Yeah.
But they kind of jumped directly from the end of TOS to the Next Generation, basically in that gap.
Yeah.
They described Roddenberry as, like, you know,
walking the desert,
like a Ronin, like a samurai without a master or something,
peddling his wares with a Majel Barrett.
And I mean, obviously, that's kind of what he was doing, but he had some input on the movies, and clearly he was still involved.
Yes,
and he had tried to make a second show.
Yeah, they make it clear this was basically just a money grab for Roddenberry. He's not particularly attached to the property. He's attached to him being attached to the property more than anything.
Yes.
He's not particularly concerned with how the show comes out. He's more, I did this, I belong on the name.
Well, I don't know, because, I mean, he did. I mean, you can't put that much effort in if you don't care. I mean, he could have very easily just
walked away. Yep.
Yeah, put an executive producer credit on there. I mean, the fact that he was rewriting scripts so extensively, you know, obviously means he had some input to it.
Yeah, that's true.
Had a certain level of, even though he didn't care in the end, I mean, he had a certain level of rules that people had to follow.
Yeah, yeah. His famous Bible.
I'm really curious what the original, like, half length version of Encounter at Farpoint would have been like.
It was probably a better script.
I honestly don't remember much about it, but the only thing I remember about it is Q, and it's like that came in later. That was something Roddenberry added.
The story is, just a weird, if this is what happens in like network, like they were arguing about the network wanted a 2-hour pilot. Roddenberry's like, there's only 1-hour pilot.
Yeah.
This turned into a fight for some reason.
Yeah.
I think it's because Roddenberry didn't want to write the 2 hours, it seems.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's tough.
Passed it off to DC Fontana, who wrote the first hour. Roddenberry came in, added a half hour by adding the character of Q, who did not appear in Fontana's original thing.
Right.
Which I don't know if the documentary talked about that as much as that was sort of a sore spot because he took the credit from Fontana.
They She's do not, talk about that.
They do.
Yeah, they do mention that. It was one of those things where they're showing all these conflicting points of view because Fontana says, oh, he took it and added Q and then just put his name on it as the writer. And, like, I guess she took him to arbitration about it. But then they cut to another guy saying, like, yeah, he added Q. He added this whole – he wrote half the script. I mean, yeah. Why wouldn't he get his name on
it? That's that guy, though, right? The personal assistant?
This guy.
Yeah.
Is that who he was? Okay.
He's just a secretary. Yeah, he's like his personal assistant.
That's dubious.
He's not a producer.
But, I mean, if he did write that much, he obviously deserves to have his name on it. But
I think she's not credited as creator, which is weird because if you write the pilot script, you're generally credited as a creator. Yeah. So I think he took just the sheer creator credit, which is...
Well, you obviously listened to How Did This Get Made?
Yep.
Did you listen to the episode where they do Crocodile Dundee 2 or something?
Yeah, with Matthew Berry.
Yeah, where they talk to the writers and they say how they wrote this whole script out and then they gave it to Paul Hogan and Paul Hogan just rewrote everything they did but changed the names and changed the jokes slightly so he would get the sole writer credit.
Yeah.
And that's just like the kind of fucked up shit that happens when you've got like writers' guilds and
when the guild
determining who gets what credit. And it's very strange.
Yeah, we're going to, in an upcoming episode, we're talking about Tin Man. The writer is there. There's two writers credited on the show.
Mm-hmm.
One of them has a middle name. There are actually three people who wrote it, but the guild doesn't allow a three-person writing team, so he took the name of the other person and added it as his
really?
Middle name.
That's interesting. They don't allow a three-person writing? That's
makes
weird.
No sense. Makes no sense.
But you can have like 14 people get a story by credit?
As long as they're all just paired up with each other. They
That's
can,
really
they can
strange.
Have writing credits. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, so, I mean, that was one of the the generation of the pilot, no pun intended, but like DC Fontana, him and Roddenberry wrote it. They added Q. They had another sort of minor insight. I think Brandon Braga was playing it off as though it was a more revelatory thing than it actually was, where they were like, Q is basically God.
God's a character, a literalized character on Star Trek The Next Generation.
By an atheist.
By an atheist. Very interesting.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, that seems kind of obvious. There's no way he's not a god. And Roddenberry's like, Star Trek is Roddenberry's version of heaven.
Mm.
Where Q is the god overseeing everything.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting because, I mean, I wonder for as many godlike aliens that show up in the original series, Q really is the most godlike alien.
Yes. You
know, there's nobody who's.
He's the only one that gets involved with ethics and morals.
Yes. Yeah. And, I mean, to go from adventure show to this new, if Star Trek is his version of heaven, it makes sense that there would be some sort of God character there. But I mean, the fact that they talk about multiple times that he was an atheist, so it's interesting to see where
where those angry things God, shake out. I guess.
Yeah,
it's funny. I mean, so the first half of the doc is basically just the old writers, Hurley coming in, They talk briefly about the Borg. Like that was
yeah,
his idea.
That was interesting. They talk about the Borg setting up in the neutral zone the next arc for the next season, which was going to be the Borg coming and then having to defeat the Borg. But then the writer's strike happened and screwed everything up.
Yep.
And I don't know how you can – I don't know if you can blame the writer's strike for neutral zone because that episode kind of sucks.
It's a terrible – but if it was part of a two-parter, the second part would maybe redeem. You know, if you introduce the Borg at the end of neutral zone, it's much better. Because honestly, our problem with that episode is that at the end they just show up and the Romulans are there and they're like, hey – they go, hey, and then they just fly off. Like, the Borg
you're
was
cool?
supposed to be in that scene.
We're fine. All right.
See ya. We'll be in a lot of episodes coming up.
I got to left the stove on in the holodeck. I got to go.
They brought Diana Muldaur back for a brief thing about Pulaski, which was,
that was
very dark.
I found the Pulaski stuff very interesting because I had no idea.
And those, the women folk.
Oh,
yeah.
Tasha.
Sorry.
I found the stuff with her really interesting because I didn't know anything about why she came on or why Crusher left. I didn't realize that Crusher leaving had something to do with the writer's strike. Or...
No, it was Hurley didn't like her. They sort of touch on
Okay, that's just editing issues because the way that they set it up, it was like Patrick Stewart says, then we came back from the writer's strike and started season three without Gates. And I'm like, oh, what does that have to do with anything?
She was the third person on that writing team. Like, fuck this.
But yeah, Diana Muldaur, not a fan of the show.
No.
He just didn't like the way the character of Dr. Crusher was working out.
There'd been a few issues over that first season about Dr. Crusher's character, and I think they thought at times that Gates was a little bit high-handed and, you know, maybe being a little demanding. I never experienced that.
I had heard that somebody said, it's either her or me. You know, one of us has to go.
She was adored. And suddenly she was gone.
We ended up casting Diana Muldaur, who was a pretty well-known TV actress at the time. That never quite worked.
What?
Just didn't get on with the cast all that well. And the character of Dr. Pulaski just never really quite solidified.
It was awkward a lot of the time.
They were not that interested in renewing me, and I was certainly not that interested. When I worked with you, we had scenes. It was all actors. By the time you got to Star Trek Next Generation, it was a vast technical world that had some characters placed in it.
Remember when we did Star Trek and we were acting?
Yeah, that was kind of weird. It's like, listen, lady, I don't know if you've gone back and watched those shows. You're not exactly doing Hamlet here.
Shatner is running around without his shirt on, punching people, and you're like, but yeah, she was very negative. And Patrick Stewart, probably his Britishness, he can't seem to say anything bad about anybody. Mm-hmm. He's like, that was a
except Good Morning America
difficult like, time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's understandable. I kind of agree with Maurice Hurley in this aspect because I think after one season, I don't think Beverly Crusher's character was very interesting.
Right.
And I didn't like Pulaski when the second season started, but I thought they got enough out of her that I was kind of coming around to it.
Yep.
But yeah, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Yeah. No, I think it's the same thing. It's just the kind of it's interesting because all these points we're talking about are really my big thing. I didn't think we were going to get these sort of angry or sort of like contentious.
Yeah.
Like things that they came out of it. And it's like I'll tip my hat to Shatner for actually getting these people to say some stuff, especially after all this time. It's been 25 years or whatever.
It seems to be the sweet spot for people to start talking shit.
Yes. Yeah. time is now. The time is over.
And I also found it interesting when they touched on Denise Crosby leaving briefly. And from her angle, it was interesting because from her angle it was, I'm doing 15-hour days just standing behind the captain.
Yes. Yep.
And, you know, I didn't want to do that anymore. And there was another guy. It might have been Hurley. I don't know who it was.
No, it's John Pike throwing some shade.
Oh, yes. And he's like, she left to be a screen actress.
She said, Denise Crosby is no Audrey Hepburn.
Yes, yeah.
This is his intro. Yeah, he's certainly a suit. Yeah, I guess, just to go through the characters, John Pike is the president of whatever company. He can't be Paramount. He was president of something that was involved with the production. So he's like the high suit.
Yeah, I don't remember what it was.
You have a bunch of writers. You have Gerald, Morris Hurley, DC Fontana, the later crew, which is Ron Moore, Brenna mm-hmm. Braga, Melinda Snodgrass is in there for a little bit. And then you have the actors. Stewart's probably the number one. He's in the most. Riker. Frakes appears for like to laugh with Shatner about something.
Most of their interview was probably unusable.
Frakes seems like he was having a jolly good time.
He looked good, actually. He looked pretty good. Looked like he lost some weight or something.
He's doing pretty well. And anyway, so the sort of the second act of the documentary ends with Hurley's great proclamation where he's probably losing his mind at this point. He's like, the actors are complaining. He's like, fuck it, I'll blow up the ship, we'll kill them all over the brand.
That would have been real interesting. That would have been, I mean, I was thinking about that, and I wish that there was more surprise available in things.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do anything without someone on the internet finding out about it and ruining it for everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, you watch shows that have big twists, and the next day the articles have the picture of the twist as the headline.
Right, like, Jesus Christ. You must watch them on time.
So, like, I was thinking, like, man, I would have so much respect if they did a Star Trek series where they had the crew go through. It's like, this is your new Enterprise crew. These are your new guys. And then
it's just the pilot. It's halfway, like
you give it a few. You give like maybe if you 12 episode season, you do 6 episodes in, you blow that fucker up. And then you bring in the new cast. Like, oh, so the story is actually evolving. That right. I would give a standing ovation.
That's like a Netflix type twist you could do on something. Yeah, it's fascinating. So they couldn't kill them. They couldn't kill them all. Hurley decides to just leave. And at this point, we can get to the weirdest story, which is the John Pike versus Patrick Stewart.
Which may or may not have actually happened.
If I'm inclined to believe one version, I'll believe Stewart. It seems more plausible than the other one.
I'm sure that story happened, but not necessarily with Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Like, he probably... that. Pike probably...
he did that to his, like, secretary.
Yeah, he probably deals with so much stuff like that on a day-to-day basis. I'm sure that probably happened.
Yeah.
And, but not necessarily to Patrick Stewart.
Yeah, Pike seems a little bit of a... it seems in his job, he sort of probably oversells things. Like, it's his job to sell. He's got to sell a bunch of people in space landing on different planets is, like, something people want to watch. His story is that there was... there was difficulty on set. Patrick Stewart didn't want to do something. And so he's like, he tells the secretary to call Patrick Stewart to the dining room on the Paramount lot.
Yeah.
Have him wear his uniform. And he's like, tell him to get there for 10. He's like, at 10:15, you can come and get me. And the secretary's like, right, but you said Patrick Stewart should meet you at 10. He's like, 10:15, you come and get me. So I guess the insinuation is Patrick Stewart is in this dining room in his uniform, and he's embarrassed that he has to wait?
I don't know. I was expecting, like, the happy version of that story, where, like, in that 15 minutes he was there, people just were coming up and be like, oh, my God, I love the show.
Yeah,
you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then when he would be like, hey, blah, 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 and Patrick would be like, ah, no, it's fine. I'm okay with this. Instead, it was like, he just waits there for 15 minutes. Pike shows up out of breath.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's fine. We'll write you out of the show. No problem. And Patrick Stewart's like, but I don't want to, what? I don't want to go. And then he's like, I never had another conversation with Patrick Stewart. Boom! And then Patrick Stewart's like, I don't remember that happening at all.
The Patrick Stewart version is that Entertainment Weekly or something. Good Morning America was on sets, and they wanted to do like goofy Good Morning America hijinks. Yeah. So they're like, oh, Captain Picard will be making like a latte or something. And Patrick Stewart comes from a pretty old school. There's a couple stories that run through about it. Like, he would get upset when the actors weren't sort of taking it seriously.
Yeah, that was the Frakes story. He's like, yeah, we're all laughing and dancing. And Patrick Stewart's like, we got to make a show.
I had never filmed in Hollywood in my life before. I'd had no ambitions to film in Hollywood. I didn't know how to wear these costumes. I didn't know how to speak or move or sit. But I was going to work and work and work and work. I would always be prepared. I would know my lines when I came on set.
Sir Patrick took the work very seriously. And if we fooled around, which we were wont to do, we meaning the Americans in the cast, and if he was not in the mood, he'd let us have it.
I thought that there was a lack of concentration and focus on the set, that people were taking this far too lightly.
We would sing and we would dance and we would wrestle.
What? Bill, you're acting like you didn't do this?
No!
Oh, Bill.
No, I actually, I was amazed that Patrick Stewart was, like, so sincere.
I know.
Like, he was the person, like, listen, we're in the 25th century. We're not fucking around, all right?
We're supposed to make people believe we're walking around on a spaceship
yeah.
and we cannot be laughing. It was a funny arc to his thing, but he does this, and so he's like, he's upset. He's like, I'm not doing these goofy cornball America things.
Yep.
I'll be in my trailer. He goes home or something, and Pike calls him, has to meet with him. They get into an argument about it, and then Pike, at the end of the argument, saying, like, you got to do this as part of, like, your job responsibility. He's like, off the record, I understand why you're doing this, and yeah. I wouldn't want to do it either.
Yeah,
so that seems like a more realistic story as to what would happen. It was just a funny everyone tossing shade on each other. Am I using that lingo correct?
I don't know.
I think that's what the kids say these days.
I think it's on fleek. Is that a thing?
Hashtag throwing shade. And that's pretty much it. Then the last third is like the new writers come in. Mm-hmm. They talk about Pillar's influence.
Well, they did talk about how they had a wall in Ron Moore's bathroom.
Yeah, in the
bathroom.
That
had the names of every writer who had been fired. And it was like three times as many writers that you should have on a show that's only lasted in like a season and a half or something.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's, yeah, I think overall there could have been, I don't know. There's a lot of interesting stories, but I feel like the focus could have been a little tighter.
It could have, yeah. It's it might just be a byproduct of the first three seasons only, because I was interested in the first couple seasons, and it's nice to see the breakdown of how things changed in the third season. I just feel like it's Shatner's attempt to put the power thing. Like, they were trying to find a theme. They're like, I don't think you need one necessarily in an hour-long documentary. Be like, just talk, because the fans are going to buy this thing. But they settled on this power stuff.
The thing they did talk about towards the end that they kind of, it's funny that they portray it this way because they actually interview this guy and he seems pretty cool about everything. Is they kind of angle towards the end where they're like, yeah, and then Roddenberry got sick, and that's when Rick Berman seized control. You know, and it's
right,
like, okay. I mean, I know that's kind of a point of contention for a lot of people, right?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But were talking to Berman, and he was...
Berman seems like a decent guy. He seems stuck to I think the problem Trekkies or whatever the fuck, are fans of the series... Berman stuck to the Roddenberry ideal for too long. Mm-hmm. Like, he went through too many series of that sort of same thing.
Yeah.
And I think he tries too hard to cling to the Roddenberry, not too much conflict. Let's keep this, like, somewhat light.
Yeah.
And by Enterprise, when Enterprise was out in the early 2000s, TV has moved past this kind of thing.
You know, I find that, this could be an entirely different conversation, but I find that really interesting because if it were me, I would say Enterprise is our chance to really do something different and push it, because it's early enough in the evolution of the human species as far as Star Trek goes, where all of the stuff that Roddenberry is like idealizing isn't really a thing yet.
It hasn't happened.
They've just got to space.
Yep.
I'm sure there's probably, I mean, like, I'm, is there some sort of, like, are the Chinese also in space too?
There's conflict between the species and the Enterprise.
Yeah, like, I feel like they, I mean, maybe, but I don't know much about Enterprise. I didn't really watch it. But if that's the way they went with it, where it's still kind of like, hey, everybody's buddies.
They're all still buddy-buddy. That's kind of, there's not a lot of.
Yeah, I feel like they missed their opportunity.
Yeah, they sort of did. I mean, I don't have a problem with Berman. The other, like, one of the bigger things that, the show I was aware of Ira Stephen Baer, and I know he becomes the showrunner of DS9. I didn't realize he was quite as influential. He was basically running the writer's room as Pillar's right-hand man. That's the way he makes it sound.
See the guy with the blue goatee?
Yeah, with the dyed goatee. So he only has two script credits. He has a rewrite on Yesterday's Enterprise, and he wrote Captain's Holiday. He talks about Captain's Holiday in this episode.
Yeah, that was weird.
But I didn't realize how influential or where he came from, but he basically came in as Pillar's lieutenant to sort of run the writer's room, because Pillar was more obsessed with more interested in running the show and doing the final rewrites on all the scripts that came out. So, and Ira Stephen Baer is a funny character.
He's interesting.
His story about Captain's Holiday, which is features Risa, which Patrick Stewart mentions as the only planet name he still remembers. we just did the podcast about it. Not a great episode, but it's funny. The this story about they have to pass everything off in front of Roddenberry, obviously. And so Ira Bear brings in this story about a pleasure planet. Roddenberry's like, I like this idea. Let's have women and dudes kissing in the background. Imply they're having sex.
No, it was let's have women kissing other women,
And men holding
dudes holding hands with other dudes. And let's imply that they're all fucking.
And Steve Bear comes back and he's like, how am I supposed to write this for
my entire career has built to this episode. Finally, I can have the episode that I guest star in.
I've mentioned it in the podcast with Modi. The original script for Captain's Holiday was supposed to be Picard goes on vacation. And it's kind of an introspective thing where he goes into some kind of technology that exposes your darkest fear. And his fear is losing the Enterprise.
Like Batman Forever.
Right, exactly. His fear is losing the Enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this introspective thing of he's supposed to be like on this pleasure planet, like having a good time, but he's like conflicted by these like nightmares about the Enterprise disappearing or him not having the life that he has. And Roddenberry just turned it into an Indiana Jones adventure because they had to focus on the thing. It's not a great episode, but it's whatever it is. Picard seems to
That was another interesting thing. They talked about how many rewrites or how many episodes Roddenberry would like take and rewrite. And it really makes me curious as to, you know, how much of the first and second season being garbage is because he was like, nope, 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 more kissing.
It can't help, right? I'd like to see the original scripts shot, like if they were actually made, it's like a total fantasy thing, but if they were originally shot like the way that you thought they would be, what that would actually...
Here's a question that, you know, who knows, but if they were to do another Star Trek series... Would you prefer they bring back some of the TNG writers or maybe like an all-star team of across all the series? Or would you prefer they did something completely new?
Something completely new.
Yeah.
I feel though, because they've all gone on to new sci-fi shows, they're pretty much spent for ideas.
That's
like
true.
Yeah, I'd have to imagine that they're a little bit burnt out. And the funny thing you realize is because you see the interviews now with them and they're all older, you don't realize, you sort of realize, but you don't think about it, they were much younger. Mm-hmm. Like Ron Moore was like 18.
Yeah,
so he's
really
super young.
I mean, even
young.
In this, he looks like he's like in mid-40s.
Yeah, mid-40s, yeah.
So, yeah, when they showed an archive picture of him, he's like, wow, he's really young.
They were the writers were young 20-somethings, which is like interesting for what you consider, except for...
I would bring back Maurice Hurley so we can finally get Miami Vice in space.
I'd have him be the captain of the new Enterprise.
I want to see Miami Vice in space. That's what I want.
Every episode would start with a cold open. We'd be like, Captain, the Romulans are invading. He'd go, this is Wacky Doodle. And then we just go to the
ground.
Phil Collins would in the air tonight would play as the Enterprise warps out of there.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah, and then...
The Enterprise would be a convertible. Take the sunroof off on the bridge.
I wonder what he's done after. I'd have to look up.
Yeah,
anyone let me know. But yeah.
Oh, before I forget, the other thing I wanted to mention, because I think it would actually have been a really great casting choice, is they mentioned they were considering Yaphet Kotto.
Yes, which was
for Captain Picard.
I felt
I would have loved that. That would have been awesome.
I felt that was. I felt that was a little bit of a PC move on the suits part, where he's like, this guy, and famous character, black actor,
maybe,
this guy. Be like,
maybe, but that being said, he would have been great.
He would have been fantastic.
He could have just been, it would have been dealing with the Romulans and arguing about whether or not he was going to get his bonus.
I mean, I know the actor. What's the biggest thing that I can think that he would have been in?
He was the black guy in Alien.
That's right. He's isn't he on like a Law and Order or something? Or he's some kind of detective.
I don't know. He was in. What's the other bit? He was the bad guy in Live and Let Die, the James Bond movie.
Oh right.
He's in a great movie which I highly recommend called Truck Turner with Isaac Hayes, also what's her name? Uhura is in that as well.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Wow.
She plays a pimpstress.
Huh.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Great movie.
Check
it out.
Yeah, I'll put a link to the guy, but he's one of those guys you definitely recognize.
No, I'm sorry. Yes, that is him. Yes. Sorry.
Okay.
I was confusing that with Across 110th Street, but Yaphet Kotto is in Truck Turner. That's right. Yeah.
You heard it here. But yeah, it was
always worrying about his bonuses.
And I sort of recognize the other two guys who
I don't think they
necessarily needed to be a part of it. That's pretty much it. That's the documentary. I'd recommend it. I think if you're a Trek fan, it's a little pricey, but I think it's well worth it. You can probably watch it on YouTube.
I don't know if there are more I don't know. I don't know if there are more insightful retrospectives on the show out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, if it's something that interests you, I would say yes.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, especially compared to, I bought the Star Trek Companion, which is like a book.
Oh, yeah.
For, it does like a brief synopsis of all the episodes as you go through.
Right.
I thought it would be useful, but it's what my fear of the documentary was going to be. It tells you nothing of interest, and it's like the blandest sort of like.
Yeah, I hate that.
It's, I mean, it's the kind of book you could have written even if you were not there. You'd be like, this person, then they wrote this script, check the Wikipedia, and then this came out, check the Wikipedia, and then this. It's like...
It's like just director's commentaries where they go, and here in this scene, what's happening is Picard has come onto the bridge, and Riker is also on the bridge, and see, here they're having a conversation. And at this point...
I wanted to film the conversation.
Romulans are going to come in, and they're going to hail them. And see, okay, see, now they're on screen, and now they're talking. And this actor, he was great. So what they're doing...
Funny story, the sound editor was sick that week, and so when
no,
I went
in... No, they don't even get into that. Like, if it's... man, I was so excited when the Star Wars DVDs came out. They had a commentary that was George Lucas, Irwin Kirshner and Carrie Fisher on Empire Strikes Back. I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And the whole thing is just Lucas and both Lucas and Kirshner going, yeah, in this scene, what's going to happen? I mean, yeah, as you can see, this is Boba Fett. Boba Fett's coming out and he's leading Han Solo into this is the place where they're going to torture him. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you can see he's getting tortured. Yeah. That's and now he's back in the
really
cage. Now he's back in the cage with Chewie. Yeah. And I think it's the next scene. Yeah, the next, as you can see, the next scene is where 3PO, see, he goes into this door because he thinks, you get the idea. But
yeah.
It's, those are the most frustrating things ever.
Everyone in the comments below, leave your favorite director's cut commentary. Mine is Total Recall, which has Verhoeven and Schwarzenegger.
That's an amazing one just because it's exactly what it sounds like. if you want like really good director's commentary, I recommend any Michael Mann movie and any Ridley Scott movie. Ridley Scott tells awesome stories.
Tell good stories. Yeah, the Total Recall is one is funny because two non-native English speakers in a room with drastically different interpretations about what the movie is. Verhoeven is very like in his head, sort of like very high saluting, and Schwarzenegger is like, yeah, this is where I shot the guy, and he's. And it's just like,
at this part it's a dream, but you don't know it's a dream. It's where I shoot him.
I shoot him. He's like, yeah, Paul, this is a great. I don't even understand now. But it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. But yeah.
You'll learn more about that on our next podcast, Arnold and Paul, where we do Arnold Schwarzenegger. And actually, that's a great podcast, doing Arnold Schwarzenegger and Paul Verhoeven commentaries for movies that they didn't make.
Just cut clips.
That's my idea. Don't steal it.
It's out there. It's on the ether.
Probably already exists.
Check out Chaos on the Bridge. I think it's $12, something like that. It's on Vimeo. You can probably get it rental through Netflix or something. I don't know. But it's out there. It's on the internet. Well worth supporting. I think Shatner did a good job. Wet eyes and all. And
has a condition, Wes.
Has a condition. Shatner, we were talking earlier. Shatner looks great for being 84 years old at the time of this recording.
Yeah.
He's certainly functional. As Data would say, fully functional. Thank you guys for watching.
Gross.
I hope you enjoyed the content. If you did and you're watching on YouTube, like in the comments, appreciate it. Let us know where we went wrong on iTunes. A rating review, always helpful.
There should have been more Tasha in this documentary.
It's true. She wasn't in all that much. But thank you guys for watching.
Also looks pretty good.
Yeah. She has aged well.
Yes.
Frakes has aged well. Patrick Stewart is the running internet joke.
Gates pretty good, too.
Yeah. Gates looks... Michael Dorn.
Diana Muldaur looked... kind of reanimated.
Yeah, they definitely, yeah.
Anyway,
they did a little something to her. It's a little hateful. Well, who on the men's side, Tracy Torme, not looking fantastic.
No. And Bear, I don't know what Bear's thinking with that blue goatee, but he looks like an alien dressed in the skin of Iris Stephen Bear.
He's just sort of puffy. Yeah, he's right there. But anyway, thank you guys. We're going to be back with another episode. We got Tin Man coming up after this. Thank you for watching. See you next time.